Okay, well, let's go into our last session then, which is in many ways the most important session, because it's a much more of a reflective session in which people can make comments. You may feel you want to ask questions, or you may just want to make a comment about what the conference has been to you. It's also really helpful to know what people are going to take home. I always used to have a rule that when I went to a conference, I'd take one thing home. Because if I took more than one thing home, I'd probably forget it. But one that was easy to remember. And not only that, it carried with it the imperative for action of some sort. So let's start then. If you have a question, you can address it to a particular speaker if you wish. If you don't, we can try and answer it if it needs an answer. So, are the microphones that are? Who's going to
I have a bell here, and that's for people who we think are not getting to the end of their point. Yes. Okay. So it may go off.
So be warned. David, you'll notice, is the left hemisphere if I'm the corpus callosum, and so he's going to be very restrictive and limited. Okay, so who's going to start?
Can I be cheeky having
control Martin,
of the microphone?
Oh, Martin, that's really nice.
I'd just like to ask a question as a journalist. Oh, he's clinked me already. This is worse than just a minute. As a journalist, I'd just like to ask, and I picked science journalism, well, because I'm more interested in science, but also it's nice and positive, but even science journalists end up reporting earthquakes and tsunamis and malaria and all sorts of things that are killing millions of people. How much of that is doing damage, because we never evolved to have compassion for more than our social group of 100 or so? And how much is it good? Because I see the other side of it. You get emergency relief being given millions of pounds as a result of coverage. Where does the compassion fatigue come and the compassion benefit when you're dealing in a multimedia world?
Nice question. Paul? Paul sounds like you.
Is it... It's a very nice question, Martin, yes. Actually, it's absolutely right. Of course, we evolved in groups of 100, 150, and compassion tends to be much easier to your in-group. That's absolutely correct. And this is one of the reasons, of course, the Buddhists argue for training. Training your mind to send compassion to all living things, because it's not straightforward. We don't send compassion to all living beings. This is why we practice imagining compassion for somebody we don't like, because it's not natural for us to have compassion for people we like. So we have to train our minds, really. The issue about compassion fatigue is a very interesting one, and again, Tanya Singer and Matthew Ricard have addressed this. And the issue is that really what fatigues you is not your compassion. Okay? What tends to fatigue us is feeling overwhelmed and hopeless. All right, and this is why Geshe was saying that when we do compassion focusing, we're focusing on how wonderful it would be if we could relieve the suffering. So you're trying to create a positive emotion, because if you just focus on the suffering, then it just drags you down eventually. And in Buddhist psychology as well, just having empathic connection, it just makes you sad. So the key with compassion focusing is to focus on this desire for others to be well. So if you see a tsunami or something like that, just focus on, I really hope that they can get it back together again quickly. I really hope there are going to be people there that will help them. I really hope that the medical establishment will be able to, and so on. So the focus is on this more of a positive desire, a real wish, as they say, for suffering to be, suffering to come to an end.
Okay, Ian, and I think probably if we can keep our answers short, then we can get more comments.
Sorry.
Yeah, I was thinking of Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, wonderful book if you haven't read it, which is about the changes in society, principally in America, but it applies to ourselves too, over the last century. And one of the things that he noted was that people gave money to things rather than got involved in helping, because they felt no longer involved in communities locally that would draw them into that, and they didn't have so much time. They were all working longer hours and so on. So signing a check has become, in a way, a kind of substitute for involvement. The thing about that is that although it's wonderful to sign a check, and I'm sort of guilty of doing that more than getting involved, it's the getting involved where empathy really grows, because it's a reciprocal process, and just subscribing to an organisation or sending off money is an entirely one-way process. I mean, the other thing is that everything being on TV, it helps to fragment empathy, in my view, because if there's a huge event like the tsunami, then you hear it continuously, but otherwise you get 3 minutes of starving children and then an advert for cakes, and you know, and then you go off to the loo and then you come back and it's a comedy show and it's loss of context.
Yeah. Yeah. Andrew?
Just to say something briefly about the future of our planet. There's an extraordinary conspiracy of denial about the human population. I mean, the population of the planet ran at less than a billion over millennia, and it's now 7 point something, and it's going to be 12 soon, and by 2025 it's going to be whatever.
No, carry on.
And the greatest source of CO2 emission is human breath. But we mustn't talk about, you know, restricting the human population, because that's tyrannical, political, and all the rest of it. I'm not coming up with any kind of answer here. But it seems to me there is an inevitability that the planet will correct this profound imbalance, and that there will be an enormous cull of the human population in the next 20, 30 years. How that will happen, whether it's epidemics or natural disasters or global warming, I don't know. And of course, it's absolute at the human level, it's almost unimaginable and unbearable, especially those of us who've got families and communities and so on. And yet I do expect it to happen. And the only way I can see past it is to hold a vision of for the planet and for the human race and for all life forms that will somehow emerge with a new consciousness, a new opportunity. And it's almost like going beyond the consideration for each other as a member of the human species, precious though we are to each other and ourselves. There is a grander design, a bigger design. Now, whether that's being stage managed by some divine presence that knows it all and it's inevitably going to take place, or whether it's part of a kind of evolution of consciousness that is developing from within, I don't know. But I'm just flagging it up, not to be morbid, but because I'm very conscious, and I wonder how much it's on other people's minds here, that this question of compassion has to be set against the backdrop of what will be by what we would normally call, you know, catastrophic circumstances, going to be massive changes to our world culture and human civilization.
Yeah, very good point. Rhonda.
Rhonda Riachi. I have an image in my mind, if you forgive me, it's a symbol and not a picture. It's the yin and yang symbol. And it came to me yesterday, listening to Ian, thinking about the shape of the brain, and suddenly I saw the sort of that curving figure of the yin and the yang, and that thing about being separate yet connected, about the fact that it's a circle. There are so many things you can read into that symbol, and it's the light and the dark, it's the feminine, it's the masculine, it's the creative, it's the organizing. So much in there, and I just thought that suddenly it seemed like a much more positive symbol to me, thinking about it again now, and I've been using the I Ching for many years, so I've been thinking about those sort of processes and how we fit into them. I wonder if each of you, just as a nice little creative exercise now, and you don't have to answer immediately, could think about one little positive symbol or picture that you'd like to share with us that we can take home and use as a creative process ourselves.
Right, who's got a nice creative picture? Do you want to start on the right and go down to the left?
The apocalyptic vision I just outlined, I don't actually see as something wrong, bad, or uncreative. I see it as part of a larger creative process, I hope.
I'm not going to be able to improve on the yin-yang symbol, which I think says everything, because, of course, it shows an apparent duality that is, in fact, a whole. And that's a really important point about the left and right in this hemisphere thing, is that only the left hemisphere sees this as a either-or and a battle. It's not. It's a symbiotic relationship in which each needs the other. What I particularly like about the yin-yang symbol is that if you look at it closely, within the yin there is a little bit of yang, and in the eye, as it were, of the yang, there's a little bit of yin.
Are you not going to have a go?
I certainly will. Letting you guys do it first.
Planting the seed and nurturing it.
Yes, I mean, for me, it would have to involve a relationship. So seeing people embracing, maybe, or holding hands or something like that would be good. In view of the apocalyptic vision, I mean, my view is this, that, look, the compassionate thing to do is to address the issues, right? The issues are we have to address our reproduction, okay? And it doesn't matter what we take on, we have to address our reproduction. That's it. Now, there may be some higher force that's going to just, you know, knock us all on the head or something like that. I personally don't see that. I don't think it's outside of us. I think if we keep looking for outside solutions, we're going to struggle, okay? We need to focus on ourselves. We are responsible. We have a mind that can understand these things. It is our responsibility. That is the compassionate, that's the spiritual quest, right? And we need to address our reproduction, and that means taking on some powerful vested interest in certain religions. That is the spiritual fight we need to have, and we need to have it. And people can be critical of that, of course, that's their right, but we need to have this debate. It is wrong to keep pushing for women to have more and more children. It is morally wrong, in my view.
Yeah, go on.
Just a modulation of what you, both you said, Andrew and Paul. Jason Drew and I do address this issue in our book, The Protein Crunch, and that there are two factors you need to take into account. One is absolute numbers, and the numbers are coming up to 7 billion this year or next, and they're actually forecast to peak at 9.5, not 12, as was thought 20 years ago, so that's good news. And have a look at my review in the last issue of Fred Pierce's book, People Quake, because the population, the indigenous populations of Europe are already declining. And so it's in certain parts of the world where things are still going on. That's part of the equation. The other incredibly important part, and actually even more important part, is the consumption side, because it's the consumption side which is driving the ecological damage. And so you can say that one American is equivalent in consumption terms of 40 Africans. And so we have an overpopulation problem, but it's also partly to do with consumption. So it's numbers times impact, which is the real thing that we're looking at, which is Paul Ehrlich's equation. So more news in the protein crunch.
Very, very briefly, in response to Paul, we're obviously thinking along the same lines here, but with reference to the Taiji, the symbol of yin and yang, they are in a state of dynamic equilibrium. If you go too far into yin, it will become yang, and vice versa. If we don't put the population problem, if we don't sort it out, then the equilibrium will be restored by Mother Earth. She'll do it for us.
Okay. I think you asked for a nice picture to take home, and I'm going to suggest the one which I showed at the beginning. And this is Echo looking after her child. and getting it to walk when it was really quite damaged by biological processes. But that carries with it the whole biological stream. And if you like, it will then link on to what the others have been saying as well. Okay, yes. Can you talk into the mic?
Yes, sorry. Is it working? Yes.
Hold close to my mouth, okay. In response to what Paul said, you said we have to attack the vested interests, I'm paraphrasing, in established religions. Well, who is we, and how with such a possible, a conceivable action or set of actions, how do we avoid what Andrew told us we must avoid?
Short answers.
All of you is we. All of us is we. And how do we avoid Andrew's? I don't know. I think Andrew would be a better person to answer that.
Who is to be in charge?
No, I mean it's a debate, isn't it? It's a discussion. It's a discussion to have, really. It's not. It's out of control.
Okay, next question. Next point, yes.
I'd just like to share something inspirational. I thought it was interesting with the riots that for all the kind of distress and upset in viewing burning houses, that it has raised this whole kind of issue of what's going on and why do people feel so alienated that they're, you know, and why is it that they're sort of rushing into the mobile phone shop to get all the stuff rather than actually sort of burning the Houses of Parliament, for example? So there's kind of a whole consumption thing. But anyway, what I just want to share this because this is something I kind of did around the whole issue of empathy, because I thought to myself, what can I do positively here? These riots are happening. We're dealing with a lack of empathy in our society on various levels and an over consumerist, materialist philosophy, so I'm going to keep this short now. But anyway, what I did was I realised I happened to know a local politician, Norman Lamb, who's a Lib Dem, who is an advisor, quite a senior advisor to Nick Clegg. And so I rang up, actually his home number, and went over and had a cup of tea and stood in his kitchen, handed him the book called The Roots of Empathy, which I was talking about earlier, which is a programme for primary school children. Also, I'd got a few things off the web about the research that had been done, and he's a really great guy, Norman Lamb, and he said, oh, it sounds really good to me, and the early years minister is a Lib Dem, and I'll go and talk to her, and I'll keep you posted how it goes. Because I said, we need money from the centre here to fund this. It's all very well going around the local charities. It's not going to happen. Now, I've no idea if it's going to happen, but I tell you, I felt absolutely fantastic because I'd actually just got up, got in my car, gone over there, handed in the book, and done something. And it struck me, the lesson I brought was not something amazing about me, but simply that sometimes it's easier than we think to actually realise we may know someone who has some real influence somewhere, and maybe we can just pop over and have a cup of tea and kind of suggest something. So I just like to say, you know, when we talk about taking action, it may not be as difficult and challenging and maybe going out in the street with a banner or whatever. It may be something fairly simple, which was just something that came to me, and I just did it.
I think that's excellent. Okay, next one. Thank you.
Can I just add to that? Because it seems to me also that although we talk a lot about doom and gloom and how vile we are as human beings, it strikes me that the amount of NGOs that exist nowadays, the amount of volunteer work that takes place, the amount of charity, the amount I just wonder perhaps if Ian, as a historian, or you know, with a historian hat, can tell us whether that has always been like that, or whether there is in fact something that has increased in society, this awareness of the others, which is a kind of encouraging or bringing about this spirit of compassion, basically.
Ian? You know all about literature.
Well, I don't know that literature will help me here.
um,
jump in while you're thinking?
Yeah.
Blessed Unrest by Paul Hawken tells this exact story. There are a million NGOs working on all these issues. And some of you may remember, I printed about 18 months ago a short commencement address from Paul Hawken, and it started with the sentence to the effect that if you're not despairing about the state of the environment, you don't know the facts. If you're not hopeful because of the amount of work going on in NGOs, you don't know the facts.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, my only thoughts, Claudia, are that I was trying to think back to, you know, when the great, you know, benevolent societies and so on grew up, and it was in the era of industrialization when certain people felt guilty, I think, really, about the amounts of money they were making, and it's good they felt guilty, and it's good that they, I'm not criticizing them for responding in a very socially benign way. But before that, I think it was more local, and it was more to do with what each person's life... I'm always sort of slightly suspicious, probably unfairly, of, you know, equating number of NGOs with what really matters, which is a change of heart. Mm. And I'm not saying they're not important, partly because of, you know, the problem that if one person on their own tries to change things... I'm not saying it won't help, it will, but they will end up powerfully at a disadvantage compared with everyone else. For example, I don't like cars. I'd like to live in a world without them. But if I don't have a car and everyone else does, then I'm really at a disadvantage. So what we need is, quite right, you need organisations that will coordinate everybody reducing reliance on the car. But ultimately, I can't see it working because you'd have to get a whole government to restrict its use of X, Y, and Z. And in the current capitalist system, that puts them at a disadvantage vis-a-vis other countries. And so they will never want to do that. And so you'd end up with having to have a world government body that did all this. And the trouble with those is they're usually either ineffectual or tyrannical. So it is quite... I'm going to be a bit pessimistic here.
Okay.
At the level, at the individual level, you know, people, individuals like Sue, doing small things themselves, whether it's a charity, whether it's part of an NGO, whether it's going to Africa and building houses or looking after. So this kind of individuals that are surfacing, and the internet, it started so much with this kind of idea of sharing. So I think that as well as the shadow that we're talking about, there is quite a lot of light going on. I don't know. That's my...
Yes,
my
no, point. I agree. Okay.
My question and my comment is to David and to Peter, and it is about the overall title of the conference, which will only happen again in 2 years. Is that right? We'll have Beyond the Brain only in 2 years' time.
Yes.
Yeah. So it is about Beyond the Brain as such. We had a lot of science about the brain in this conference, which was wonderful. We didn't have a lot of science about that which is beyond the brain. And I'm longing for a science of that which is beyond the brain. And I would like to connect this conference with the previous one, which was scientists and mystics. And the same applies there. We have an assumption that the science is about that which is physical. The rest must be mystical. And I am missing the spiritual science. And in the conversation we just had with Andrea, I think the overall tone was, what about the science of that which is beyond the brain? And I remember, David, your question at the end of the last conference, Mystics and Scientists, about the Dream Conference. And you posed this question, and it was not responded to, the time was over. But your question was, reflecting that so much of what we talked about was the subconscious. So we've got the brain, the physical, the conscious, and everything spiritual, subconscious. And you pose this beautiful question, David, saying, I thought there is in what is spiritual more than subconscious. I thought there is some consciousness in the spiritual. What about that? And nobody responded to this. So I just want to bring a certain longing and a wish that we will not define science to that which is physical and only mysticism to that which is not. It is a question and a request for a synthesis in the future. I am longing for spiritual science.
Thank you, Hugh. Very, very good point. I think one needs to see our conferences over a 10-year period or even a 20-year period, because Some of our conferences are devoted to specific topics and others to other topics. And if you put the whole thing together, not every conference can cover everything. But I think what one of the things that we have been doing over the last 15 years is we've been developing a science of consciousness and a science of consciousness where science is within consciousness rather than consciousness within science. That's one point. Second point, another way of putting it, is that we're also developing what Brian Goodwin calls a science of qualities to complement the science of quantities, which is what's been developed largely over the last 200. So subjective science as well. The work done by Goethe obviously builds on that. And then next year we're looking at scientific and spiritual perspectives on the subtle body. So that will be... There will be a large component of what you're calling spiritual science in that. But we always welcome suggestions for other themes to develop. I think on the parapsychological side, obviously, we do have quite a lot of parapsychology in our conferences, but then that's not our complete remit. That's covered more directly by the Society for Psychical Research. It's one of our allied organisations. So point taken, and keep watching the space.
Okay, thank you, David. Julian, this is the last comment of the conference.
Well, it'll be quite a brief one, I guess.
And it's absolutely right that it should fall to you.
Oh, well, I was just going to back up David in a sense, because I've been at all previous Beyond the Brain conferences, all eight of them, and I've actually reported them in the journal. And certainly, I think if you take them together, they cover a remarkable band of human endeavour and questioning and thinking and feeling and being. So I would certainly support David strongly in that. And I'm sure they'll continue to do that. The other point was in relation to what Claudia was saying. I mean, I remember the 1950s when I was sort of just growing up. It was a much more stiff, rigid, intolerant, ungiving, structured, in a way successful in its own terms, but much more constricted than life is today. Life has changed enormously, and in many ways, for the better. We are much more open. We can talk about things like sexuality, which are very important in human life, after all. We can disagree effectively. I'm not saying things are perfect, far from it. It's obvious that we need to be pessimistic sometimes. But at the same time, the contrast between the flavour of life in the 1950s and the flavour of life in the 2010s is very great and largely beneficial, I would say.
Okay, thank you. That's a wonderful comment to end with. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Andrew to say a few words, I'll say a few words, and then David to sum up the conference.
Thank you. It's funny how certain things just stick in the mind. I'm remembering, I think it was Peter said, we used to talk about the God spot. Now we know it's networks of neurons. Was that right?
Yes, it's
yes.
Right.
And I have that picture of the brain up on the screen. But it's networks that are oscillating, fluctuating, illuminated. And I like that because that's also how I feel that we are functioning as a body, metaphorically speaking, as an organization. And particularly with regard to that comment about the influencing MP, who had influence, Lamb, yes? Actually, the influence came from, I don't know your name, I'm sorry. Sue. The network member, she was the influence. She took the initiative. She went round to the house. And it's as if that's the way, maybe, that we're going to be able to create the contagion of health, if I can put it like that, a pandemic, not one of virulence and disease, but one of a new way of understanding, a different kind of consciousness. And, of course, once it gets going, it can spread like wildfire. So although I've painted a rather dismal picture, at the same time, if it's not too paradoxical, I would like to suggest that what we see here, both in the scientific presentations and in the way we talk together as a group, is the seed of that kind of new consciousness that knows no bounds, that can go around the world in not 80 days or 80 seconds, but 1 second. So I'm an optimist at heart, and I really got an enormous amount from this conference, both in terms of learning new things, many doors opened, and the quality of the presentations, and I feel privileged to have been invited and to be able to be here with everybody. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrew. That's very, very nice, a wonderful comment. For myself, it's been a great conference. I mean, there's no question about that. A lovely conference, lovely audience, lovely people. What am I taking home? Well, I have to take home one thing. I think the first thing I'll take home is this idea of love and people requiring things and then people having things in dukkha, or people who are suffering. So I think that's one thing. The other thing which I'll take home is the levels of compassion. I think that was very important that Tasha talked about. And also, I think for me, the idea that it doesn't come free. You have to work hard on compassion if you're going to get it, and I think that's very important. But one thing has been missed out, and that is the neuroscience of compassion tells us that when you make a compassionate act, you fire up your reward systems. So it doesn't occur in just by itself. You get enormous kickback, so you can all go out and be compassionate and get this wonderful high from doing it. I'd like to just say two things. I'd like you all, please, to congratulate Paul for his OBE, for his outstanding work. So I think we ought to do that. Thoroughly well deserved. And I wasn't able to this morning, just because of the situation, to thank Sue Bayliss for taking the meditation. So thank you, Sue, very much indeed. And I'm sure we'd all like to thank you. And finally, I'd like to thank David, because nobody else can do, really. David, as you know, is our program director. And I think he and the committee have really produced a wonderful conference. So please thank David and the committee very much for everything they've done. And now I'll hand over to David.
Thank you, Peter. And what I'm going to do is just make some thanks myself first and make a few closing remarks. Well, I'd like to thank, first of all, the speakers, because I think people have put a huge amount of effort into researching and presenting with great passion and articulacy what they have to say. And from my point of view and program committee point of view, the way the conference has played out has been fantastic, and it's no small measure due to the speakers. So I'd like to thank both those present and absent. And also thank you very much to Peter and Andrew, and other people vital in our operation, the program committee, Martin on sound, without whom how would we damage, and recording, and Sharla, of course, who I hope is within earshot. She does an incredible amount of work, both here and behind the scenes in preparation of the conference. Sharla has got an incredible eye for detail, she's an incredible asset to the organization of these conferences. I'd like to also to thank those people who have helped Sharla, particularly Paul, but also I think Marilyn's been at the desk, and various other people have been at the desk. Sorry? Natalie has been at the desk. So without them, you know, the conference would not run very smoothly. So please, big hand for... Now, I'm just going to make a few brief remarks to close the conference. Aldous Huxley was once asked what his advice was to people. And he said, well, it's a little embarrassing after 45 years of research and study that the best advice I can give people is to be kinder to each other. And that seems to me something we can obviously take away from this conference as well. I think we've struck, the word zeitgeist came in. That the fact that we're having this conference at this time is part of what we're grappling with. And what we were able to do was to bring together a scientific, cultural, psychological, and spiritual perspectives to have a very rich couple of days, understanding the issues from different points of view. And one of what I got out of it myself is, first of all in the same boat. That's been used both by Geshe and by Paul. We're all connected. Life is tricky, challenging, but life is also ecstatic and wonderful. You know, we mustn't forget these other sides. But suffering, the understanding of suffering, leads to compassion. But compassion in itself is not enough, because compassion must develop courage, as you pointed out. Courage must be turned into commitment. Commitment must be sustained with faith and dedication, and that has all got to be expressed in action. So I think you have this. You have the intent, the courage, the attitude, the commitment, the dedication, and the action. And that we need all of these. If any part of those is missing, then the link is going to be broken, and the link between the inner intent and the outer manifestation of that intent will equally be broken. I also very much like this idea of the switch. And this is a very practical thing that we can do ourselves and every day. You know, are you in your threat mind, your fear mind, or are you in your compassionate mind, your love mind? So this is something that we can maybe do as a kind of memento for the conference, is just to sort of draw a switch for ourselves, or imagine we have this switch, and then be aware that there is a switch that we can throw. A switch that we can, and help other people throw their same switch. Now, my final remark is that I do think, I mean, so is every generation thinks that they're at a turning point, but we are seriously at a turning point in the history of the planet, not just environmentally, but for all sorts of other reasons as well. We have a reflection on this coming up in the autumn, as you know, Apocalyptic Patterns of Thought, and we're moving into a period of really considerable turbulence, but we can actually continue to live creatively through the turbulence. And the thing that I was put in mind of was a remark by Albert Schweitzer, there's an Einstein remark very similar, when he said that our task is now to expand our circle of compassion to include the whole of humanity. Now, we do this in small bits, because we have to, but each of us can ask ourselves, have the switch, okay, got the switch, how can we expand our circle of compassion? We can all do that. And so this is another question you might like to take away with yourself. And I'm going to leave you with three quotations. The first one is from Brian Tracy. Hit me like a bolt when I heard it first. If you want things to change in your life, you're going to have to change things in your life. Think about it. If you want things in your life to change, you're going to have to change things in your life. Second one, last autumn, Claudia and I and a few other people were lucky enough to do a tour of the cathedrals. I think one or two people are here. And we went to Reims, or Reims, as the French say. And in front of Reims is a meeting point of the French and the Germans' reconciliation. And this is 1962, and de Gaulle came with Adenauer to have a service of reconciliation in Reims Cathedral. And Archbishop François Marty was the cardinal who officiated, and written on the stone there, I'll say it in French first, se tendre la main est bon, se tendre le cœur est mieux. To proffer each other the hand is good, to proffer each other the heart is better. And I have one final quotation for you from Edison, and that is, if we did all that we were capable of doing, we would literally astound ourselves. So I'll leave you with those thoughts and invite Claudia to come up, ask if she's got any final word to close the conference, and then we'll blow the candle out.
Yeah, a couple of things that come to my mind, and hearing what the speakers just said and what David just said, reminds me that last week we had a talk by Rick Tarnas, and in his talk he mentioned heroic communities, and the Scientific and Medical Network is a heroic community, heroic coming from hero, the journey of the hero. And that's what we are. We have broken new grounds by when the Scientific and Medical Network was first created in 1973. And it seems to me that we are continuing to do this. And every person here is here for very similar reasons. And I think this in itself is very transformative, because just being, we don't even need to do anything, we just need to be, and we are transformation agents in our own communities. So I'd like to thank you very, very much indeed for being here, for coming, and for helping us in our work, hopefully to produce a better world. And just the other thing that I want to say is that Bernard Carr, who is our chair, who couldn't be here, he extends his apologies for that. I don't know if you mentioned that he's also a member of the programming committee. Yeah, he's a member of the programming committee. So I want to thank my colleagues in the programming committee, particularly for all the work that they have put into this conference. So thank you very much indeed.
Can you help me blow the candle out? We need all your help to blow the candle out. So if we all stand up and blow, we might manage to get it out. Blow out the compassion to the world. Thank you. Thank you.